Screwtape Letters, Spiritual Warfare in the Flesh. How many of you have read the book? Almost all of you. So I'm going to... I have given notes that were, first of all, notes for myself. So they're not polished. They're not unusable by you, but they were really an attempt I made just to summarize chapters. And it's not everything in the chapter. It's a summary of the chapter along the lines of what I'm going to develop for you in just a minute. We most likely will not have time to make it through all of the chapters. If there are some that you want to skip ahead to, feel free to ask toward the end, and we can let this develop as conversation. C.S. Lewis is developing in Screwtape Letters, of course. It's one big long satire. And in this satire, we have a senior devil, Screwtape, who is writing to his nephew, a junior devil, about how to take care of, in the interest of hell, of course. So the whole book is inverted. You need to remember that. And most of the notes, not all of them, are written in that same voice. So it's just summarizing what Screwtape is telling Wormwood. So don't read this or you'll have it all backwards and we're giving satanic advice for your spiritual growth. Do keep that in mind. That's how the notes are written also. But we have a senior devil giving advice how to take care of what he calls his patients. And just like you have a guardian angel, so in this book you have an anti-guardian demon. And it's the job of this demon, whose name is Wormwood, to make sure that his patient doesn't enter into God's presence joyfully at the end of his life. So that's the book. Now, I'm working with a thesis on this book, and most of the notes are in that vein. That number one, that it's about death, because I'll give the book away for you, since most of you have read it anyway. At the end, he does die. And that, of course, that's the great and final, ultimate failure of Wormwood, that he let his patience slip through his fingers and into God's presence as a real Christian. All along, there has been a course. You have the typical trip through the seven deadly sins. C.S. Lewis is also working with virtue, so he's virtue and vice, and then also the stages of growth. The first of which is purgation, the second illumination, and the third union. And we've just launched into Trinity Tide again. The first few Sundays of Trinity Tide teach us the love of God. And then in Trinity 3 through 9, we have this first cycle of going through the seven deadly sins under the rubric of purgation, getting rid of sin, just stop, get out. Then illumination is the second stage, and we have very heavy language of the Holy Spirit in Trinity 10 through 16, that having been given God's Holy Spirit, we see Christ clearly and we grow deeper into the Christian life. And the third stage is that of union or perfection, union with God, wherein we are brought more fully into this life, this participation in the Godhead Himself, as we read in 2 Peter chapter 1. Now, Lewis is very aware of this, and this is a young Christian. He becomes a Christian early on, the patient does. And his main point is you need to stop him from establishing the virtues. And a virtue is habitual goodness, and it's not just in the mind. So I've collected notes around that, first of all, that for C.S. Lewis, the earth and doing things with the body, the physical world is not just marginal. It's at the heart of how to tempt this guy and bring him back into the fold of hell. So he writes of our Father below and the hierarchy below and the high command below. So we have this inverted order you need to remember as we're going through the book. But he has this continual reminder, you need to be very careful in using the material world. For example, in chapter 1, you can't just turn him into a materialist, and there are two reasons. One, the material world really belongs to the Creator, the enemy, capital E, is God in this book. So the material world belongs to the enemy. If you turn him into a materialist, that is a double-edged sword. It may not be a very good temptation at all to get him to love the world, because you're on enemy's turf. The other is, don't argue him into being a materialist, because once you use arguments, you're really on the enemy's turf, because reason belongs to God. Therefore, it's far better just to use jargon. Suggest ideas. Get him to make huge steps without passing through argumentation. You want him to damn his soul in the way that he lives in the flesh in the world, but you need to be careful that material things can also turn into the Creator. I'm also going to go through war. This is written at the advent of World War II. And, of course, the young demon just thinks it's great that there's a war. All kinds of terrible things will happen. Much cruelty, much unchastity. This is a demon's delight. But Uncle Screwtape is going to write, and not so. People think about eternal matters during war. So be careful how we tempt them. That gives you a bit of an overview. I was asked yesterday, could you pause at a few points or talk a bit more practically? What does Lewis have in mind in terms of what does this mean for the body, our habits? If his goal is to be so practical and anti-Gnostic, then what are some of the actual things he's talking about? So I'd like to do a little bit more of that today with you. Feel free to ask. So that's the first part of the thesis about this anti-Gnosticism that Lewis has in Screwtape Letters. Now, that, first of all, the world, it belongs to the Creator, the enemy, and it's a good thing. And then, since we're moving towards death, is death some of the basic tenets of Gnosticism. Salvation means escape from this world, not knowing God in this world. And so this world is just something we're passing through and we can't wait to check out. And as Paul says, absent from the body, present with the Lord, and it makes that statement everything about the attitude toward creation, including the new creation and the resurrection. So Gnosticism is not interested in the resurrection of the body. Salvation means getting out of this nasty world. Salvation is also by private knowledge. So you get a few ideas that other people don't have. And now that you have certain ideas in your mind, you are among the saved. And then also in Gnosticism, those who have these ideas, this private knowledge or gnosis, become an elite society. So now you can look down on everyone else, which is something that we always enjoy doing. Lewis is really hammering on these in Screwtape Letters. And salvation, how is this young Christian going to persevere to salvation? And since our job as demons is to get him to apostatize back to our Father below, how can we use this? And what do we need to watch out for in the enemy's tactics? The other is death itself. So is death just a happy separation from the body? So I took a tile.
I think I got it from my grandparents. It's written by Jan Larkin. It's Dutch. And it shows more of a Gnostic piety. So we have here the fruit of the pits. This is back to pits. The nut that's inside, or the seed that's inside of you, is the right seed. Good stuff.
So the seed, once it is freed from the husk outside, and it's talking about a seed of wheat, kernel of wheat. The kernel of wheat, that once it's freed from the husk outside, only then is usable for bread. And so the heart, the inside of human life, even though it's housed in the mortal outside of flesh and blood, will be gloriously relieved thereof when God effects a good or happy pardon. So is death just a happy pardon of soul and body? There is that element. It's maybe the first quarter of the story. It is true, absent from the body, present with the Lord. There's no word of resurrection. There's no idea that the Christian hope is the resurrection of the body in the full renewal of all things in the creation. No idea of that at all. Lewis is deaf on these ideas. And I'm sure there are many other wonderful things going on in Screwtape Letters that either I'm oblivious to or I'm not exploring today. I think Lewis is dealing primarily with this idea as a way to unhorse the young Christian in particular. So that's how we're going to deal with him. Satan, Peter tells us in 1 Peter 5, the epistle for two Sundays ago, Satan prowls for prey. He goes about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Now, Lewis is going to use that verse in both poles of that verse. Number one, he's seeking. He is on the prowl. Lions go hunting. A spider may build a web and wait for the fly to come. The lion goes and hunts. That's the picture of Satan that we need to have in mind as we live the Christian life. Secondly, Satan is interested in devouring. Yesterday it was brought up in one of the lectures, what is the nature of hell? Well, you'll have to see a little bit more of that from Screwtape Letters. What is the nature of hell from Screwtape Letters? It's a place of, it's really the ultimate concupiscence. Concupiscence is selfish desire, a desire directed toward the self for self-satisfaction. And therefore, contrary to a number of Anglicans today, concupiscence is a word that's highly necessary in the language of the church. Because there's nothing else that really says it in quite the same way. Hell is the quintessence of concupiscence. How's that for some words? And so Uncle Wormwood, or Uncle Screwtape, is your affectionate uncle. Well, as the book develops, and as poor Wormwood is losing his prey, his patient is becoming ever closer to God, and finally is taken by God in death, Wormwood is on his way down to hell to find out his affectionate uncle has been wanting to devour him. Mrs. Rawlings from the Harry Potter series, Nathan gave me a book to read, I scanned part of it, and one of the things this author points out is she is familiar with all of these same sources that Lewis would have read. She's brought up something. And so I'm thinking of the Dementors, which is very much like what Lewis is developing here. You know, remember the Dementors are these creatures that suck all joy and life from the soul and leave this lifeless and joyless remnant of a soul behind. And we've been hearing about that this week. So hell, Satan seeks to devour, and so he's prowling, and he wants to take in. So the delight that a demon feels is he feeds off the fear of his patient, for example. He says, you know, unlike us, the creator, the enemy, he really does love these vermin. He calls humans vermin and these hairless bipeds. Because it's unimaginable to him that God would actually love. Love is impossible. So one of the great mysteries for the hierarchy down below, and our father below has his whole research team on this, is what is the Creator really up to? Because nobody truly loves. My good is not your good. And if I look like I'm pursuing your good truly, I'm up to something else. Because every being only wants to absorb. Well, that's the idea of devouring that Lewis is taking from 1 Peter 5. So he writes to Wormwood, the enemy isn't like us. He views people as cattle.
They are food.
We view people as cattle. They are food so that we can feed on their souls.
The Creator really does seem to love, and he gives to them.
All right, well, let's launch in from there. Christian behavior first, since Screwtape Letters is largely about behavior, and I want to focus on that in the flesh. I borrow a couple of thoughts from Christian Behavior in Mere Christianity, where he talks about morality as being necessary on three levels. His picture there is a fleet of ships. The first is that every ship must be in order internally. If the rudder post cracks on one ship, it can't be controlled. If you haven't done oil changes on your diesel engines, eventually the engine is going to quit. The ship has to have internal order if it's going to function. Then secondly, each ship must remain proper distance and relative direction from one another, or you'll have crashes. Just because the destroyer is so much faster than the cargo ship doesn't mean it can just run circles around it. They have to have their own relative direction and speed. And then thirdly, the whole fleet has to stay together in a unified direction. Just because you all put out from New York Harbor, every ship may be in order, they may be monitoring relative directions and speeds, but be going wherever they want, and
they won't all end up at Southampton
unless the whole fleet goes the same direction. So morality has those three issues:
your own internal order,
the group of people moving in the same direction or being aware of one another, so loving
God,
loving your neighbor with your relative speed and direction, and then there's also the
community. There needs to be a moral community.
And he recognized in 1941 that they were already very much in the breakdown of all three of these, but especially that last one. Christian society isn't really there anymore. And if he said that in 1941, we can imagine what he would say today. Remember, the Christian, the patient, is very young. He's new. So the question is, does temptation lessen with growth after the first probation? He's going to trace this young Christian's life. It's terrible that he's become a Christian. But you can stop him. Not all hope is lost, because he has not yet developed Christian habits. Those are the virtues. What he does with his body and when. You might look at your calendar and your checkbook, it said, when you discover your priorities. You also, it's not the only value of those, you also discover what your habits are. Virtues are habits. So he's a young Christian. He's latched onto ideas about who Jesus is and the triune God. But he has not yet adopted habitual Christianity. And that means, Wormwood, you have high hopes of getting him back to the fold of our Father below. Because, in other words, once he starts living like a Christian, once he starts developing the habits, it's a whole lot harder to get him back. So that's where it starts. Then, and so we have some temptations geared for that kind of person. Then we have this Christian. He does seem to be falling away. Christian life isn't quite as fun anymore. Morning prayer was really neat when I first came into this, and now it's become a bit of a pain. It's a discipline. I no longer have, now that I'm 1 year into this, it takes work. I don't just naturally relish the disciplines. So what's going to carry me forward now? Screwtape recognizes that it's the enemy's design. While he could just force people, he could just smother them, he could just rape them, ravish, all the language of domination that hell likes to use, Screwtape says, the enemy doesn't do any of those things. He really wants them to exercise their own will. So he's actually going to let him fall away so that he can come back on his own. So we have him falling away, not just by getting other ideas. It begins, surprise, surprise, by the company he keeps. Praise be to our Father below. He is now among an excellent company of friends. I'm thinking for you. Who are the artists he now admires? What is the music he listens to? I remember the horror I had once. One of my first interactions with Anglican youth. We went on a mission trip. And I thought, wow, this is great. And I had taken students from our school. I'm going to introduce them to something so wonderful. And most of the young people on the trip, this is before cell phones, they couldn't wait to get to the hotel so they could turn on MTV. It was one of the biggest bubble bursts of my life.
That's exactly what Screwtape wants Wormwood to effect.
And he delights in the company that he's keeping.
He wants the approval of the godless. He's listened to godless artists.
So I listen carefully. What do I learn about my students from life outside of school? How do they talk about church and school when they no longer have those restraints? Because that's a sign of what Screwtape has been writing to Wormwood. And I watch that very carefully, for it's the loves that reveal the heart. So he's going to go through that. Of course, this is a great opportunity, he says, for non-chastity. And then he goes into this trough. We discussed that a bit. But then the worst thing happens. He has a second conversion, and he falls in love with a really good Christian girl. So we're going to pick out a few of those and then see if we can move past that.
Remember, we talked about habits.
So in his first chapter, he says, don't worry about it that he's he's having these ideas. Just because he's interested in Christianity, you can get him back. In fact, I once had someone in my care who was at the British Museum. He had been seeing all these things. He was keenly interested in becoming a Christian. He was thinking about really dangerous things. The enemy was moving in. I could tell my man was going to convert. And I remember argument is the enemy's turf, so I couldn't use argument. So I suggested to him that this matter was so important, he really ought to have lunch first, because he could think about it better then. And by diverting his attention that he really was hungry and needed lunch, the idea soon passed, and by the time he was on his way home on bus 73, he wondered, well, that was kind of strange that I was thinking about that today, and he is now safe with our Father below. Press upon him ordinariness. Well, in chapter 2, the patient has become a Christian. While it's bad, it's not irreversible. One of the first things you need to teach him to do, now that he's come across these ideas, you know, he's an intellectual, he has accepted the idea of God being a Trinitarian God, the second person of the Holy Trinity becoming flesh. But now he walks into church, and there is much good that you could do there, Wormwood. Just have him look to the left and see the grocer. He's despicable. Have him despise the man next to him. And he says, you know, it's really funny. These humans have never figured out one of the most obvious things in all the world. That they're all like that. It's what the grocer thinks about him. And he said, no matter how old these humans get, they never figure this out. This is a temptation you can use over and over again. Just teach him to despise the person next to him. It'll work pretty much all the time. And if you can get him to do this about the parishioner next to him, and then looking at the church building, say, who designed this? I thought I was worshiping the eternal God, the King of Beauty. But I walk into this, sitting next to her? So use that. Good chance you'll get him back really early on. This conversion can be temporary. Don't worry too much. Chapter 3. So far, so good. Let's work on the home now. He lives with his mother. Teach him to quarrel with her. But thinking he's spiritual all along. There's really great methods. If he thinks of conversation purely as interior, and notice here I'm picking out this anti-Gnostic again, not the actual words that he uses. Have him think of conversation as interior, because that way he can imagine himself to be spiritual. He really is concerned for his unconverted mother. But he speaks to her in a disrespectful way. Well, that's not very important. What's important is that he thinks of conversation as interior. Lewis's anti-Gnosticism. Secondly, make prayers for mother to be spiritual while he's still thinking of all the irritating things she does. And then, better yet, get him to pray about the irritating things that she does. The point being, you want him thinking about her irritating habits. and to imagine that he's being spiritual in prayer. Have him think of each other's irritants as intentional. It's just another thing about human beings. When they start living together for years and years upon end, they know all the things about the other that irritate them, and then they start imagining that the other person actually does it on purpose. So all mother has to do is lift her eyebrow, and he can think, she knows how that annoys me, and she always does it on purpose. And so by getting each of them to think this about each other, you can have them each imagine that they're righteous and condemning the other. Teach them this, and you'll guarantee that they always feel misunderstood by the other. And he said, human beings fall for this all the time. This is a good temptation your whole life. And if you're really good at this, Wormwood, you can have them misunderstanding each other and having their feelings hurt their whole life long and thinking bad things about each other, all without even saying a word. Remember the enemy's story of the elder brother. Chapter 4. Keep him from serious prayer. And there are two ways to do this. Number one, you can exploit this idea that, you know, real prayer is interior. Now, I don't use any written prayers. I only pray from the heart. And he quotes Coleridge. I'm not going to look it up right now. You can look it up when you read the book again. The Coleridge quote of genuine prayer is the interior. Some men need pews and kneelers. I can walk the hills and form my thoughts of God in my soul. So to do that, we want him to remember these parrot-like prayers of his youth. Yeah, when I was a kid, my parents made me go to a parish school, too, and I had to go to morning prayer and just say blah, 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 every day of my life. Thank God I'm relieved about that. So get him to think of his childhood as all these parrot-like prayers from which, thank God, he's now delivered. That's a good temptation. Remember, human beings always measure the success of their prayer by the intensity of their feelings. In fact, at this stage in the Christian life, he will be trying to conjure up feelings because he suspects that if he doesn't feel certain things when he's praying, he isn't really giving prayer to the enemy. Apparently, Screwtape has done a really great job with this because we accept the language in the church. Well, he isn't really praying. Or I'm not really praying. If I just went through the liturgy and I didn't do it very well, but my body was moving, my mouth was moving. Did you pray? Well, God does want your heart. Lewis understands this very well. You're not going to make it through just by being a parrot. But by thinking of childhood prayers as parrot-like, you can successfully inure him from the whole liturgy of the temple. The other thing you could do is capitalize on idolatry. Perhaps he's looking at the cross. Perhaps he's looking at candles. Perhaps he's looking at an icon. Get him to think that he's praying to the physical thing. In other words, by the way, the church already settled this well over a millennium ago. The difference between worship and reverence. And so just because in the 1500s, an extreme part of the Reformation thought they'd revisit it, so I go back to Reformed churches in Holland where they took the hatchets and just whacked all the faces off the carvings in the pews. They left the rest. The Church of Jesus decided this back in the 6th, 7th, and 800s already. But what Lewis is saying is that you can get him to become an idolater. That's why we have iconoclasts in church history, because they do see that people tend toward idolatry. The Reformation was needed. So Lewis says, by using both of these, you can get him drawn away from true prayer in either direction. Have him believe that true prayer is always interior and only words that you make up yourself. Or get him to pray to the crucifix and think that he's praying to the crucifix. And either way, you can get him to avoid real prayer. Non-physical prayer and idolatry are both useful to shield him from the real presence. He says, remember, these human beings are not like us demons and angels who can see God and experience in him all of his searing light and glory. These human beings actually just bumble around in the world and they get to enjoy his good gifts. They bumble right into his presence and God is so mild they just have a good feeling about it. But we demons, we cringe in utmost pain in the presence of God. But God is using the material world to prepare these poor vermin so that they can actually come into his presence with joy. I'm thinking also of in despising the physical in worship. It is interesting, the Psalms, bow down as ye draw near. God wants you to use your body. And so in the history of the church, we have the church coming up with different things. Augustine had about 40 sacraments. Putting the sign of the cross on yourself was one of them for him. The church settled on the seven, the two dominical, and then five or more others. But really, all of life, the whole material world is sacramental. Can that be abused? Yeah. If you watch World Cup, you see people putting the sign of the cross on their baptized body, which is rather that same body, which in sports is typically rather unchaste. But putting the sign of the cross is going to be a big deal to them after they make a goal or win a game. I'm not saying everybody's a charlatan, but there are public examples of saying, well, this doesn't seem to mean a whole lot. But the temptation from hell, from Screwtape, is don't get him to use his body. Teach him that worship is always in the mind. And better yet, if you can teach him that using the body, the way God taught Israel to use the body, right? Exodus 20, the giving of the law. No idols. Kind of. Certainly no idols. Chapter 25. You shall make graven images in the tabernacle. Trees, almonds, grapefruits, pomegranate, and God even uses the word graven image. How do you square that? It's not the purpose today, but Lewis is capitalizing on this because within the church, you get people thinking really extremely about these ideas. The farther separatists to one side and a very high sacramental identity on the other that gets abused. So people love to fight about this in the church, and Wormwood Screwtape's advice is use it. Because either way, you can divert him from true prayer. Teach him that prayer is interior. Don't use the body. Don't cross yourself. He brings up a particular in the book. You know, teach him not to kneel next to his bed. Christians have done this for millennia. Teach him not to. He can pray to God just as well from between his sheets. So you know what Lewis thinks about that now. But don't use the body. Because we know the enemy wants people to use their bodies in worship. He commands Israel, don't come into my presence without bowing down. Who do you think you are? I'm the king. And so the church sorted this out in all these early centuries. You know, we do acknowledge the presence of Christ through the cross. You need to remember when you're acknowledging the front, it's a place of consecration, actually, on the altar. But we recognize in our bodies that Jesus is king. There are three things that usually go along in the church when people have a hard time with this. They become very uncomfortable with the humanity of Jesus. They become very uncomfortable with the humanity of the Scriptures. And they become very uncomfortable with the goodness of creation. And so they're highly uncomfortable in using the body to worship the incarnate Lord. So it's time to reread St. Athanasius on the Incarnation. All right, so use this. Chapter 5. There's a new war, new European war. Wormwood is drunk on the thrill of feeding on the human soul's fears. Screwtape says, you blithering idiot. He's become a Christian. If he dies now, he goes to the enemy. Your number one job is to keep him alive. Now, yeah, war is really useful. And this is where he says, there will be much cruelty and unchastity. And people go to war for all kinds of stupid reasons. But you must now focus on preventing virtue. Because war is also used by the enemy. Remember, the main thing I'm picking out of Screwtape for you today, and as far as we get, is the idea. He calls Wormwood at the beginning of the book a naive, somebody who's unaware, because this untrained devil thinks that he can get his guy, his patient, to reconvert to Satan by using the material world. And throughout the whole book of Screwtape letters, Screwtape is telling Wormwood, no, 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 don't be stupid, don't be stupid, don't be stupid. What you thought was a good idea, the enemy actually uses. It turns out the enemy actually uses everything. But he especially uses the material world to convert people. So even war, we don't want him to become habitually virtuous. Rather than enjoy the war because of all the sins people commit during war, don't enjoy it. Use it. I don't care if he becomes a patriot or a pacifist. It really doesn't matter to hell. As long as that becomes more important than the kingdom. Our desire is that you might delight in all these young men dying and children being killed and the innocent civilians. But remember that during war, men write letters home before battle because they know they might die tomorrow. There are people making peace with God left and right before battles. That's not a good thing for us. So keep this in mind. War is also used by the enemy. The enemy is really unfair. And during war, people actually believe in causes. The enemy is so unfair that he even lets people believe in all these causes that at the end of the day, it may not be that important. It might not even be a very good cause. But remember, you dumb nephew tempter, that they believe in something. That's the danger. It's far better for us if we just use peace, not war. Because it's far better for us if they just go on through life and they learn to be moderate in all things. And you can get them so contented in worldliness, have them enter the nursing home after a long life of just being contented with worldliness, and they will graduate to our Father below. The enemy, another reason war is not good for us, is that the enemy has taught them that suffering is part of redemption. And so war is not going to be nearly as useful as you think it is. Chapter 6, concern, what to do. Versus what might happen. The temptation here is, again, it's about this Gnostic idea of the interior versus the exterior. If you can get your patient to worry about what might happen, that's infinitely more useful to hell than get them to think about what to do. Duty, you know, that terrible word in contemporary Christianity.
There's a lovely word for C.S. Lewis, and he says, remember,
the day before battle, the day before anything, these vermin are thinking about what the enemy wants them to do. They're thinking about duty when they plan tomorrow's activities. That's bad. They're likely to love God and neighbor if they're planning for the next day, thinking, what does God want me to do, instead of saying, what do I feel right now? So the more, as a demon, you can capitalize on what I'm feeling right now. Oh, so-and-so told me to do this. What do I feel? There's a battle tomorrow. What do I feel? What am I afraid of? What might happen if? Cultivate fear and uncertainty. That's good food for hell. Even while he prays, thy will be done, he's fearing that he might die tomorrow. Lewis almost quotes, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But that's what he wants to cultivate in the patient. Let him fear all kinds of things. But once he starts praying, thy will be done, not just that he might die in battle, but thy will be done about my fear, then he's in great danger of belonging to the enemy ever more thoroughly, once he's given his fear to God. So we don't want that to happen. And in war, don't worry about making him hate the Germans. It isn't going to work. He says, the English are just milksops anyway. They might talk about hating the Germans, but as soon as they shoot down one of their planes, the guy hasn't parachuted down for 3 minutes before they're offering him milk and toast and tea. It isn't going to do any good to teach him to hate Germans. What you need to do is teach him to hate his mother, his friends, and his neighbors. He has to hate the people around him. Don't waste your time tempting him to hate the Germans. It's not a good use of your demonic time. So keep, and then while you're doing this, keep virtues in his idea of fantasy. So virtues always need to be a really nice idea. We want to be virtuous. Yeah, we can even have a pep rally about it. We want to be virtuous. And you could even have all kinds of paraphernalia that go along with, we want to be virtuous. Let him do that. That's okay. It doesn't even concern the interests of hell. Because keeping virtue in that realm is fine. They're not going to do anything. They're still going to listen to the same music. They're still going to do the same things with their boyfriends and girlfriends. They're still going to cheat on their tests. He's still going to be drawn to the wrong friends. He's still not going to go to church. He's not going to organize his calendar. You notice all these things that Lewis touches on are with the body again, the material world. So as long as virtue is an idea, it's fine. But once virtue becomes what he does habitually with his body, you better watch out, because you might never get him back then. So that's what we need to work on in the advent of war. Make sure that virtues are never embodied. Always remain ideas. Plenty of people like ideas. I always remind our parents in school. People in their own school, but it's going to be a lot of work. You like the idea, but getting there, that's the process. That's tough. It's really difficult because we're asking people to do things we don't naturally want to do. That's the difference that Lewis is having Screwtape capitalize on here. So don't let them embody virtue, just let them love it in their minds. And then we'll all be okay. And he'll end up in our Father's house below. And he says in chapter 6, in fact, if you're good at this, Wormwood, if you get good at this, it makes hell an absolute scream. Because there's no delight for a demon like helping your patient imagine their whole life long that they really did love virtue. If you can get them to believe that they have loved virtue all their life long, but never really did, they never embodied virtue, the despair in hell is just so much richer and sweeter. So he wants him to work on that. Chapter 7. Question is, should he know that I'm here? He says, well, generally the high command says no, we should be concealed. We can only come out in the open after people quit believing in the enemy, God, so completely that they'll actually listen to materialistic magic men. You can, I'm sure, imagine who they are. The materialist magic men who can explain all the wonders of the universe without God. Mm-hmm. But who don't believe in spirits. Then we can start coming out of the closet and showing them that demons are real. Regarding the war, make him an extremist, same as last chapter, just like cliques and parties of high and low church. If people argue about high and low church, you don't have to give them a whole lot of tempting time because they're already taking care of themselves.
Don't worry about it.
These inane arguments that happen in the church are of incredible use to hell. So just get him involved in one of those and you're all set. Now, however, if he becomes a pacifist because he's trying to find the will of God, that's another story. Don't go there with your temptations. If he's just becoming a pacifist or an extremist, because he wants to go rah-rah, or because he wants to line up with other people, or better yet, if it's because he's a coward, that would be good. But if he's trying to do this because he really wants to follow God, watch out. I said yesterday, one of the imaginary conversations that most priests have is young people coming to them and saying, how can I best serve in the kingdom? I'm wondering whether I should marry or not marry. What gifts do you... parents have these imaginary conversations too. What gifts do you think that we have, that I have? How should I direct my studies? What kind of person, if I'm going to marry, what kind of person ought I to marry? Instead, they show up, we're getting married on September the 21st, and we want you to be there, and here's what the deal will be. It's not quite that bold, but the point is, and Dr. Seale did a good job a few years ago at AWI in telling people you're married for the sake of the kingdom. And I'm not just talking about marriage here, I'm talking about everything in the way that Lewis does here about his pacifism. If he's thinking about becoming a pacifist because he really is concerned about how to love God, you better watch out because he's serious about the faith. That's what we look for in everyone. All of these, any of these decisions. How can I please God? That's what we want to see in College of Prayer. One of the bishops have made his own conference, the Anglican Way Institute, so that we have young people, College of Prayer, saying, how can I please God? Not, what is it just that I have my mind set on doing? So the important thing is that he does not use temporal affairs as material for obedience. He chose that word again on purpose for Lewis's anti-Gnostic thrust in this book. Even the issues that he's struggling with, make sure he doesn't use them as material for obedience. Either way, he can use his Christianity to bolster the cause. Whichever cause he signs up, just let the cause be more important than the faith, and you're all set. Chapter 8. Wormwood is all delighted that his man doesn't really care about church. He's sleeping in sometimes on Sunday mornings. If I go to church about half the time, so Christian life, right? He's not thinking about the Lord's day, his body being the Lord's body. There's another chapter I doubt we'll get to. He says, here's a temptation for you. It's about time, but it's also about his body. Make sure he thinks about time as his time. And so when people interrupt him, they're entering into his time. So the worship that he brings to God is really his gracious offering to God. Because time is mine. The body is mine. Have you ever heard anybody say, it's my body, don't tell me what to do with it? It's my time, don't tell me what to do with it? So what is your only comfort in life and in death? That I am body and soul, both in life and death, belong not to myself. That's my comfort in life and in death. That I, in body and in soul. It's too bad people don't grow up in catechism anymore. They might remember that. I belong in body and soul to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. That is my comfort. So, this man is on the downside. He thinks that time is his body is his, and next chapter he's going to start falling into bad company, bad friends. He's starting to slip away. Wormwood is thrilled that the patient is slipping away. And again, Screwtape says, "You moron. You're pure spirit. The enemy made these people amphibians. They're half spirit, half animal. Have you ever heard of the law of undulation? Waves. They're normal. They're part of the created world. Because he's half spirit and half animal, he's all over the map. One day he likes roller coasters, next year he doesn't like them anymore. Now he wants to play this video game, and next year I can't believe I was so stupid to play that one. I want to play the oboe, I want to play the flute, I want to play the drums. I like bananas, I hate bananas. And I can't believe I was ever so stupid that I enjoyed that book or I liked that song, because now I think she's ridiculous. These are the laws of undulation. I'm all hot fire, I want to play soccer every day, and I'm going to practice, practice, practice. And then a few months later, oh, do I have to go? That's what human beings are like. That's the law of undulation. So Screwtape writes to Wormwood, "Haven't you heard of this? And because they're half animal and half spirit, they're amphibians, they function on this. And the Creator is so unfair, the enemy is, just because your man's on this downside, the enemy isn't going to step in. He actually wants these vermin to make decisions on their own. So he's just going to leave them there. And he'll probably do some things that he shouldn't do and that will grieve the enemy. But the enemy wants him to choose to come back. He's not going to drag him in. He's not going to force him. He really does want them to use their own will. They're not just cattle. They're not just fodder." And this is the chapter where he has that. "We view humans only as food. But the rumors of the enemy really loving them are true. He really does. We are empty and seek to be filled. He's full and overflows. He seeks those united but distinct. He doesn't overwhelm, cancel, or annihilate. He makes himself resistible and refutable. He uses the troughs for movement of the will, to seek him, to stand on their own legs, to do of their own will those duties which have lost their relish." So when you no longer want to pray, when you no longer want to go to church because it's the Lord's day, it never was yours in the first place. When you don't want to put really 10%, when you don't relish putting that in the offering anymore, what's going to carry these poor vermin through? Well, thankfully, if we've done a good job tempting, they only do the things they relish. Because they've been taught that's being genuine. That's being authentic. You should only do what you really want to do. You should only offer words that you make up on your own. In fact, if you do something you don't really want to, you're a fraud. So if we've tempted them for that, then yeah, troughs are great because that's where they get off the bus. But the enemy wants them to use their own wills. He doesn't tempt. He says, you need to remember this. He doesn't tempt to virtue as we do to vice. Satan tempts people to vice. But the enemy doesn't tempt them to virtue in the same way. He really is inviting them. And he's so unfair. You know, he asks them to give up everything. Take up your cross. He wants them to give up life, everything. And then as soon as they do, he gives them the whole world. He really doesn't. He's not trying to suck them dry. He just wants them to follow him willingly. And once they do, once they die to themselves, he gives them more life than they could ever imagine. That's how unfair this game is. So, dryness in the troughs is a much better opportunity for temptation than the peak periods, because the energy of resistance is also highest at the peaks. Pleasure is the enemy's invitation, and much less useful than despair or weariness. So, hide these natural oscillations. If you can get him not to think of these ways, if you have him think of, you know, despising phases. And here he says, you know, phase criticism is the greatest way to dismiss any author, so that even our contemporary scholars, very few of them are blessed by the wisdom of the ages because of phase criticism. They just view an offering as a phase. Well, that was his premillennial phase. That was his evolutionary phase. So, have him think of his own interest last year as, yeah, I was really interested in the church then. It was a phase. So if you can get him to think of that, then he'll move on happily. New friends.
got moved on a little bit longer.
Great, he has new friends. They're modern, effects, uncommitted. They sound really intelligent. They appeal to his vanity. Play it so he'll betray himself in the small things of conversation and become embarrassed. You know, make him want their approval. You want him to want the approval of the worldlings. That's what you're after. So maintaining both parallel worlds. Have him think, I can be a Christian here, in this setting, maybe home, church, school, and I can be something very different over here, and it'll both work, like two tracks. And in fact, I'm so suave, I'll be the train that rides them both, and I really will be genuine in them both. Have him think those kinds of things. Maintaining parallel worlds. It will make him think of himself as urbane and sophisticated. At the same time, spiritual. That's what we're after. These friends are laughers. He says, no, moment on laughter. How you can use that as a devil, too. They're different levels. There's joy, fun, the joke, and then flippancy. Joy and fun really are the language of heaven, so we don't really want to know that. But the joke proper is still good. It's extremely useful to us, though, because you can do a lot of damage with jokes. And then if you can move one step beyond to being flippant. And you ought to have no patience with flippancy. For this reason, he says the flippant assume the joke. And therefore, it's unsaid. And so it's free from all of the dangers, you know, to hell, all the heavenly dangers of joy. If you can just get people to be flippant, it's pretty much completely inoculated from all the dangerous joy that heaven gives us. And people will think that it's joy. They'll talk about themselves as having all the joy, but they're just flip. And it's 1,000 miles away from joy. It deadens instead of sharpening the intellect, and it excites no affection between those who practice it, he says. So those who get used to being flipped with each other aren't building true affection with one another. Chapter 12, he uses the collect for this week, without whom nothing is strong. The safest road to hell is the gentle one. Exploit tedium. Cards are just as good as murder if you're distancing from the light. Now we're coming into some danger. I wanted to deal with these. And then, of course, he makes connections. I'm going to go quickly through others. But I want to spend some time on this shift here. He's angry that Wormwood let his man slip through his fingers with a second conversion. Now, sometimes people have been brought up in the faith. They say, you know, I feel like I never really chose Christ. And they hear all, maybe there's grand testimony from someone who lived in the world, and they became a Christian, and there's a great testimony that goes along with that. Well, I was just raised in the church. I can't remember a time I didn't follow God. There's nothing very exciting about me. But in every stage of every human, whether they're brought up in the church or not, there are some critical times in human development, in the stages of individuation. You know, adolescence, early adolescence is one of them. Early 20s is another. You go through something again later in life. In fact, you'll go through a series, but those are two really big ones. Adolescence and then early 20s. You'll be making, whether or not you were brought up in the faith, you'll be making decisions. Will I embrace this for myself, yes or no? So if somebody's brought up outside the church, they're making that decision to become a believer then and there. But even they, and you know, that's what this case is, but the second conversion is much more dangerous than the first. So those brought up in the church really ought to think of their upbringing in the church as the first conversion. Their parents converted them, taught them how to pray. The second conversion, so you can be glad about this, the second conversion is more dangerous to hell than the first conversion. So at that time in adolescence or in early 20s or whenever it is that people choose, say, no, I will stay in the faith. I do own my parents' faith. I do own the church's faith as mine. That's a far more dangerous conversion than the first. Because the first one, you know, he's likely to say all kinds of stupid things. He probably even posts on Facebook, my 10 great resolutions. I resolve from this day forth to do this and this. And we have all these grand things about what he's going to do. And there is all this excitement about being a new Christian. But it's not maintainable. The second conversion is far more dangerous because he says, now he's praying, Lord, just help me through this day. Help me to be virtuous today. This is really, really dangerous. And you, Nephew Wormwood, how stupid can you get? And here, this is where we have the Gnostic theme again. How did he slip through his fingers? You let him read a book he just enjoyed. Pleasure. And then he walked down the country lane and had tea at the mill. It was through pleasure and beauty that he found God. So your job was to keep him thinking about himself. Because when the human vermin think about themselves, they don't think about God at all. You let him enjoy the world. What happens when you enjoy the material world? And he says it is so simple. All they need to do is see a butterfly going by. Or look at a flower. Have a cup of coffee. Enjoy a friend. And the enemy is broken through. And they belong to him again. The enemy uses the material world. So you must keep his imagination and affections away from his will. Here's a triad that I hope you remember from this workshop. Imaginations, affections, and will. The task of hell is to keep imaginations and affections away from the will. The business of heaven is not just willpower. It's the business of imagination and affections tied together. All right, you're going to have to read the rest for yourself if you're interested. We need to look at 16. That one is very useful. Why in the world is he still going to church? You need to turn him into a connoisseur, seeking a church which suits him. The parish is a community of place, not of likings, where he's a pupil. That's what the enemy wants. You need to turn him into a critic, so he can find the parish that suits him. And gluttony, not just an excess, but a delicacy. Oh, no, it's way too much. I just wanted half of that. It's also gluttony, Lewis says. Or, he says, no, for guys, you need to have much more vanity thrown in. The only place in New York City where you can get the best steak is here. Have you ever gone? That's gluttony also. Chastity and war, love. Notice the worst thing that happens to him is he falls in love with a good Christian girl. And he spends a good bit of time exploring that. The war comes, and now he actually does. He's behaved in the worst sort of way. He was afraid of war, and he acted courageously. And he was killed. And he was ushered into God's presence. And therefore, Wormwood will go to the place of concupiscence, where Screwtape will suck his soul dry. Rest assured of my affection for you. I have always desired you. How could you let him go? He saw you. He saw them, the angels. He saw him. He saw that you were a fake, and that death was like a shower, putting off dirty clothes. He got through so easily, you moron. This animal, this thing begotten in a bed, could look on him. Your increasingly and ravenously affectionate uncle. I imagined that we would have time to talk about many things. I want to talk about incarnation. I want to talk about use of the body in worship, the theology of the body altogether. And then end with portions of the Great Litany, which have us pray around these things. We're not going to. We're there for your use. Thank you for listening so patiently.